I always wanted to know who the best player was on tour simply because I wanted to actually work as hard. And then I ran into a little guy by the name of George Knutson out of Canada. And I watched him hit the golf ball. I watched him with the wide stance, taking the club back way inside, releasing the club. One of the greatest ball strikers I'd ever seen.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the McKellar Golf Podcast. My name is Lawrence Stoingen and I am joined by my co-host, Jeff Shackelford. Shack, what's up?
The usual stuff. Just recovering from an exciting Players' Championship and getting ready. I'm the MC of the SoCal Golf Hall of Fame on Wednesday. We're inducting five people, including Scott Simpson and Ely Callaway and Roger Cleveland. And so it's going to be a very nice ceremony if I don't screw anything up. And hopefully I'll get through it. I've already got the pronunciation of Ely down, so I think we're in good shape. The Chip Brewer, the CEO of Callaway, is coming to accept on behalf of Mr. Callaway. And Roger, of course, is still very much with us and a bit of a legend. It's a special day for Southern Cal. So I'm excited and, wishing I was in the Bahamas with all the private jets, taking in the meetings and seeing who got invited and who didn't. But I'll survive missing that one.
I've got a couple of requests for your Southern Cal Hall of Fame dinner. One, can you ask Scott Simpson, course record holder at Koalau Golf Course in Oahu, in Hawaii?
Where?
Koalau.
Which you wrote about in
McKellar. Can you ask him why he didn't return my phone call?
I will.
University of Hawaii golf coach. You can also ask him why his team's so crap right now. Don't do that. Koalau, speaking of Koalau Golf Course, if you haven't yet purchased issue 7 of McKellar, issue 8 is coming soon. Issue 7, the cover story is written by yours truly. It's about Koalau Golf Course, but there's a bit of economic history in there. Jeff, that was a golf course that broke the slope rating, the highest rated score golf course in America.
Right.
I think the slope rating went up to 162, and that was rated at 164. So anyway, and my other Roger Cleveland, you can ask him if he remembers me. I went to Callaway HQ to write a piece a few years ago. Went down to the wedge shop, and there was an old boy there just playing away with these wedges. I didn't even know who it was, and he said, "I said, what are you doing?" He said, "I'm fixing my wedges. I've got the member guest at Chicago Golf Club this weekend." So,
he wasn't tinkering with designs. He was just getting his own stuff dialed
in. He was getting his own stuff dialed in. Anyway, that sounds like a great night. Didn't you do that last year? Who got in last year?
Yes, they invited me back, shockingly. Yeah, so I'm back. And I think he's the second most influential person regarding the sand wedge in the history of the game, right? Other than Gene Sarazen. And everything that Roger did made the sand wedge better. But now everybody makes basically a knockoff of Cleveland wedges, and I mean Callaway is knocking off Cleveland, but of course they do have the guy who actually really is the mastermind behind it. Yeah, I don't think he gets enough credit for, because I was looking at an old Dynapower wedge doing some cleaning the other day that I have here, and I was like, this isn't as good. He sculpted those beautiful lines, and anyway, he's a great guy too. So it's a neat thing.
He is. The Southern California, I tell you what, Jeff, what a golfing history it has. What a heritage it has. It's magnificent. Every time you come across or you go to some event or you look at junior golf or college golf, my goodness, there's lots of great players down there. Well, I was out this morning, Jeff. Not that you asked what I was doing, but I'm going to tell you. I was lucky enough to go up to Meadow Club, Alistair McKenzie's first design in the States, to watch the Northwestern golf team. They were playing a qualifier. My goodness, Jeff. These qualifiers are taken pretty seriously. But it was great. It was a beautiful morning up there. Our son, Niall, was playing away. I think he shot a respectable 68 on his golf course. He's on golf course. But I'll shout out to this kid's going to be a great player. Daniel Svard, the Swedish, another the product of the Swedish development system. Never seen the golf course before, shot 63. Just fantastic. Following up, they all trapped up at the late course yesterday up at Olympic Club, and he's never seen the golf course before and shot 65.
Wow.
I'm not sure he's on the Ludvig Åberg level of talent, but my goodness, the Swedes really
pretty good.
are churning out. Very quickly, I've got a shout out. Can I do this? Do we do shout outs in this podcast to Medical Club member Dr. Al Oppenheimer, who is also a listener to this podcast? He managed to get them out, so it's pretty good. You know, these college teams have all got all sorts of supporters and fans who try and help them out. So that was a wonderful morning. They were all pretty upset though, Jeff, that they missed the climax of the Players' Championship. How about that for a segue, Jeff? Straight from a morning of college golf, straight into the Players. It was by miles the best golf tournament of the PGA Tour season so far. I guess I should just ask you, what were your general thoughts before we get into the bits and pieces of details?
Yeah, it was a great tournament. And I think it was a reminder of what you and I have discussed on this very show, which is that the things that make a golf tournament great are... it's a wide variety of things. It's the way the telecast works, the fan energy, the performance of the players, the course, the weather, you know, good weather. They haven't had good weather since they moved back to March. The weather was lovely. That you could tell that made the fans happy. The players were happy. They were swinging freely. They were mashing the rough freely. but they, you know, it was just the whole package, which you hope to see, which was, a reminder that blowing up the model of the PGA Tour in the name of fighting off LIV is just so short-sighted, because here was a full field with a cut. So the first 2 days had drama because of the cut, because of some really good pairings and some weird stuff that happened. And weird things always happen at TPC Sawgrass, which is part of the reason it's a compelling tournament course, besides, you know, great finishing holes and things like that, that I didn't care for the rough. I just couldn't believe how ridiculous it was. It didn't matter, by the way. The guys just still bomb it so far, and it just doesn't seem to faze them. But yeah, so I thought it was a fantastic week, and I hope they take a lesson from it, that all these ideas to try that they think they have, or that the strategic sports group has, you know, don't reinvent the wheel. There's a reason that this format of four rounds with a cut and a full field is why how the majors are played and how the sport's been played for over 100 years. And I doubt they'll learn that lesson from it.
the only thing, as you're saying that though, Jeff, I'm thinking, well, the complaint before was, oh my goodness, another 72 hole stroke play event week after week after week after week. I guess there hasn't been many of the 72-hole stroke play, full field, 36-hole cut. I'm guessing that was part of the appeal of this week. But I'm sure you're not arguing for a season-long of 72-hole stroke play tournaments, are you?
No, exactly. The thing that, various people have argued is to not alter the format, but to just introduce, you know, the occasional match play, the occasional team event, those kinds of things that are a different format in terms of just general format. But in terms of the actual week to week, for most events, this is what works best for fans, television, etc. And they've been just chipping away at that all year, or all of last year too. And it's been confounding to see. And we know why, and I think it's all for the wrong reasons. It's to enrich a group of people who happen to be so-called stars at the moment. And by the way, the people who are in these meetings and spending all this time on this are not playing very good golf, which we knew would happen. And that should be taken note of as well. Scottie Scheffler, I mean, he pays attention to this. He's made clear he has some views on it, but he's hardly putting a lot of his time and his energy into this, and look what's happening. And same with Wyndham Clark. He has opinions on it, but he's not spending his nights sending memos and all this talking paradigms and all this nonsense that Patrick Cantlay's putting out there. And I mean, Jordan Spieth's game is clearly not very good. So I hope they learn a lesson from it, but I I'm not confident they will.
They are giving up their time and energy for the of what they might conceive to be the greater good of the community. So, that should be noted and credited. But you are right, Cantley. Ricky Fowler's on the is Fowler on the committee? I can't remember.
He's on the
Fowler.
pack,
Yeah.
I
He's
believe.
on the pack. Okay, well, he was another one. Spieth obviously missed a cut. Yeah, you are right. It's time consuming. Mind you, Rory left the policy board, and he's getting worse. Maybe he should go back on the policy board.
Oh, here we go. He made 26 birdies, Lawrence. Why don't you curse him right now? Just say, do your Matthew Fitzpatrick on him.
Yeah, that's oh,
but
I should mention that. Yeah.
Well, but there is an
go
interesting
on.
point on that. You do, I mean, there will be a point here. It's still way too early to know, but. Did Rory being in the middle of that, did that has that given him a little bit of an edge the last couple of years, and a little bit of a focus or a distraction maybe, and now having his full focus on his game, is it going to cause problems? Again, I think it's just way too early to tell. I told you after Riviera, he looks to me like a veteran who is pacing himself. Yes, he's playing a lot, but he's
Yep.
also to me. Trying to peak at certain times of the year, and no offense to the players, but it's just not one of those events
Yeah.
that he's really trying to peak for.
You are right. The well, I shouldn't, last week's harangue about Matt Fitzpatrick chasing speed. I got so many texts, and oh my goodness, I'm thinking, oh my God, it takes me back. I think some people will know this story. I think it was 2007. I can't remember. I wrote something about Darren Clarke that was pretty dismissive, and he, lo and behold, Darren Clarke read The Guardian for the first time in his life. Took the cutting and put it on his fridge, and he was waiting in the long grass until when he won the Open Championship, and that was the first thing he said at the Open Championship presser. It was so funny. So I'm if you actually look at that, I think it's what's those that series Golf Channel did, Makings of a Champion or something. It's a series of good programs, actually.
Yeah, it's actually the RNA does it, and
It's
I
very
believe
good.
IMG's involved in that, but they're fantastic. And yeah, no, Golf Channel just airs them, but yeah, they're actually put together by the RNA, and they are amazing what they get in the way of admissions from players in those. It's a different format as well, but in your defense, well, if you want to continue, but in your defense, Fitzpatrick did have somebody discover regripping his driver. There was a 4 gram weight that was left in there that shouldn't have been in there. So
But
I
you
don't
know
know how
what's
that happens, but that it seemed to change things for him.
I thought that was a bit weird. I mean, surely pros are changing their club more than their grips more than once a year on the
That was,
driver. That's
yes, that was a question I had as well. That surprised me, but.
my antenna were twitching on that. Anyway, just to finish that answer. So the quote, the thing I wrote, something about the inexorable de decline into golfing irrelevance that was astoned out in the makings of a champion. Anyway, well done, Darren Clarke. That was a great. He played brilliant that week. Really good stuff. Yeah, getting back to McIlroy. You're dead right. I mean, I'm sure he wants to win the Players. He has won the Players, but he really did. He shot 65 in the first day with what appeared to be a I thought it was a touch of the kind of Tommy Fleetwood golf swing, that little cut-off finish, which I really love. I hate to see him hitting short irons with a big flourishing follow-through. I think it lessens his control. Not that I would know much about that kind of stuff, but I really loved watching him the first day. It was great to watch, but then he followed that up. He was all over the place after that, 73, 69, 72 for a tied 19. So yeah, I think you might be right. He is getting himself ready, hopefully, for the Masters. We'll see. But he's going to have a lot of competition. That was again, we talked about the. It was a really, and certainly in the context of modern PGA Tour golf, that was a pretty good leaderboard. I'm reading it. Well, the top five: Fitzpatrick, then to Clarke, Schauffele, Harmon, and Scheffler. That's about in modern term. That's just about as good as it can get. You want to throw in McIlroy, I guess, but that was a pretty stout. Leaderboard at the end and a really great finish, very dramatic, some great shots, some poor shots. But in the end, Scheffler, 64, So with a bad neck, of course, 67, 69, 68, 64, 20 under par. That's his second successive Players' Championship. I don't know what to say, Jeff. You highlighted a few things.
Oh, unbelievable.
I wrote them. I mean, would you want to go through them? The scoring stuff is. You also in the quadrilateral, your newsletter, you also highlighted some stuff that Kyle Porter had found. I mean, just amazing numbers. 51 starts since January 2022. 9 wins, 3 missed cuts, 34 top 10s, 5 top 10s in major championships. He's a combined 540 under par, and he's made not that it matters, but not that he cares at this stage, he's made a tidy little 46.3 million.
Oh, he cares.
Anything else?
well, I mean, the 22 top threes in those 51 starts. I'm still stuck on the bogey free stat. So Sunday was his 45th. Bogey-free round since 2020. Yeah. I mean, it's just when you think about the courses they play, again, I don't care how juicy equipment is, how far they hit it, how perfect the conditioning is. That's insane. And then he has a bad neck and he does it. That was his 8th straight round at TPC Sawgrass of 69 or better. Which, yeah, again, crazy. You know, it's a golf course where just – strange things can happen. You can get a funky bounce and make a 7 not having hit that bad of a shot. He hasn't been over par this year, which was mentioned repeatedly on the broadcast. He hasn't been over 71. It's just a stunning level of consistency. And I guess what makes it maybe even more shocking to us is, well, one, we don't see many players doing it anymore. I think, you know, Tiger has touched on this a little bit with, yeah, how much I'm reading Bob Herrick's book, we're gonna have on the pod, and he devotes a chapter to the cut streak and how much Tiger valued that as a statement of consistency and trying and never giving up. And Tiger's talked about the modern mentality is quite often if you're kind of out of it, some guys throw in the towel, they miss the cut, not maybe intentionally, but they don't exactly grind. Yep. And here comes the guy who's feet are all over the place. He's sliding and he's got these funky follow throughs sometimes. And one of them, you know, at Bay Hill looked like Arnold Palmer, which was fun, but and he's a model of consistency in a game now where you don't see it as much. And I mean, even Wyndham Clark, look how great he's playing. He missed a cut at Riviera. He threw in one other clunker besides his other great finishes. So it's just, it's an incredible performance, and of course, also mentioned a jillion times on the broadcast, the first to ever repeat there, which is fascinating that it hasn't happened. But in that tournament, not just TPC Sawgrass thing, but of course, it used to move around in the early days. So amazing performance.
There was lots of talk. If only can putt moderately well, and bang the numbers. Well, tee to green first. Off the tee first, approach seventh, greens and regulation third, putting tied 37th. I mean, it's just there's a template. You know, you just got all the ball striking stats down, and then you putt great or you putt mediocre or averagely well, and he seems to be hard to beat. There's been a lot of the Tiger comparisons. Oh, go on, sorry.
Well, one other thing: do not underestimate, both with he and Wyndham Clark, how incredible those guys are around a green, getting up and down. They are absolute magicians. And we know that with Clark from the U.S. Open last year, but Scheffler is so good. You know, that was the key to winning the Masters, really, were a couple of those shots he got up and down with where people really struggled to chip around those greens. And he's just magnificent. He's got all sorts of little shots. You've seen it. And I think that gets overlooked a little bit in the obsessing about his putting and his incredible driving and iron. Generally, his iron play is incredible. Every once in a while, it's a little bit off. But his wedge game is spectacular.
Shout out again to Phil Kenyon, who's been working with Scheffler on his putting. Phil gets a lot of criticism from certain quarters, but he keeps just doing his work quietly. So good stuff on that. I guess we should maybe go through the top of the leaderboard. Brian Harman, well, Harman, Shoffley, and Clark were all in a tie for second. Anything you stuck out to you on any of those guys, Shaq? Harman's pretty slow, isn't he? That really stood out to me.
Oh, it's awful. It's just awful. And NBC did their best to try to hide it. And I wrote, you know, in the newsletter today, I find it offensive that they couldn't, because Kevin Kisner's in the booth and he's a fellow Bulldog and they're buddies. We kept getting, well, he's working on it. We used to hear that about Ben Crane too. Well, you know, the problem is we have a rule and you're supposed to hit a shot within a certain amount of time and they just don't enforce it. No, never, never. And the one time we got to him early was on 11 when he had an eagle putt, and I guess Tommy Roy had nowhere else to go. And we joined him midway into his routine, and it still took a minute and 8 seconds from that point on. We don't know what he'd done before that. So it's it's just painful. And I get that he doesn't want to hit the shot until he's ready. But at some point, you have to pull the trigger, and they took 425 those last groups yesterday. Saturday they played really fast, but yesterday was just an absolute slog. And I mean, you know, you have a lot of people there on that leaderboard who are not fast in those final groups. Scheffler's not super fast. Clark is not. Harman's not. Shoffley's not. There are really no speedsters, actually. I guess the one thing I'm still struck. You and I chatted a little bit about it. Brandel and Paul McKinley had a great conversation about Clark and how he's not reliant on a swing coach watching him every 20 seconds. And I was fascinated by Shoffley, how hard he and Cuomo were working on his swing Saturday night. Friend of the pod, Sean Martin, put up some video, and Golf Channel showed some stuff. Golf Channel showed Colin Morikawa hitting balls into the dark. And, you know, I think there's a lesson in Scheffler being with the same coach his whole career. And I'm not criticizing Shoffley, because it sounds like, you know, he needed to come up with a reason to keep his dad away for a little while. But it is fascinating to me. And I sent you a thing. I almost texted Brandel because he was talking. He was really on a roll discussing essentially the idea of self-reliance and how that'll make you a better player if you can kind of figure out some things on your own. And I reminded you, and you know it, but you know, the instructors used to leave on Wednesday evening, and now they're becoming like tennis, where they have to be there for every shot and stand there with the arms folded. And it's again, I'm not knocking Shoffley, because this might be a really positive thing for him, but it is a little bit painful to see all this obsession about the coach and the role of the coach, and if the player's playing well, it's the coach is doing, and if they're bad, it's the coach's fault. And I watched some of the tennis from Indian Wells last week, and the obsessing about all the coaches and the shots of them. I really hope golf doesn't go down that direction.
But too late, Jeff. too late. Actually, you're talking about, you are right. I think it's Randy Smith. Is it Randy Smith as a Sheffield's coach since childhood? I think that's a big thing. The guys who, I think Tiger's probably an exception. He's an exception in a lot of things, but a lot of the players came through, players who are doing well now, or, you know, they stick with their long-term coach, their childhood coach. We're talking about Matt Fitzpatrick. He's with Michael Walker. He's been with Michael Walker and Phil Kenyon since he was a teenager. Hasn't done him any harm. Ludvig Åberg, being with the same people, although I think Peter Hansen now travels with him. With the Clark thing, I thought was fascinating. That was a really interesting conversation. Complete self-reliance. It's him and his caddy. Although it didn't stop him throwing his caddy under the bus on Saturday night, but that's okay. The Shoffley thing, I think that he's moved to Florida. That's the only way to get away from his dad. He's moved to Florida. Again, I saw you talking about Brandel. He was defending Chris Cuomo. I'm not sure. I think McGinley or somebody was saying, well, wasn't Cuomo around when Tiger had his worst spell? But I think that maybe
is that the student or the coach or the body? I mean, it's kind of unfair, I think, but
Yeah, the other one again, fascinating to me. I mean, Morikawa has fired his long-time coach. I think it was at Rick Sessinghouse. I think the guy's name is.
Yeah,
and he's moved to. He's been with. I think Sessinghouse was a driving range pro that Morikawa just hooked up with when he was a young kid. He's now moved to Mark Blackburn. I'm not sure how that's going to work. It certainly didn't look like it worked out, or isn't. Doesn't look like it's working out too great. But we'll see. He's a pretty good player. Actually, for Morikawa, I'm sorry. Things started to go downhill when he was on the first season of Full Swing with the dog on the private jet, and the dog was wearing doggy booties. I'm sorry. He lost me. He lost me at doggy booties, but hopefully he'll get his game back. The anyway, just a fantastic tournament. I want to talk about, Jeff. You were very praiseworthy in the quadrilateral over the TV coverage. While I was cooking dinner for 13 college golfers and their three or four coaches last night, I was listening to the No Laying Up podcast, and they were very complimentary. I mean, it seemed like a peace pipe had been smoked at some point between NBC and No Laying Up. So the TV coverage overall, you speak to this much better than I do, but from a layperson's perspective, I just thought the commercials, but the reduced commercial load makes a world of difference. Yeah. It allows the people who are doing the show, who are clearly all very good at their job, to express themselves in visually and storytelling. I thought it was wonderful. On the Golf Channel Live From, I think there's clearly something up between the Golf Channel and the PGA Tour. There's something going on there. But McGinley and Chambly they're just brilliant together. Rich Lerner as well, who's never been my cup of tea, but as a three ball there, it was brilliant. Just loved it. I mean, I'd sit late at night and watch the replay. Really good stuff. I don't know, what did you see in the TV coverage that made it so
well? Same as you, limited commercials. It's funny, the limited commercials actually, I felt like, brought a calmness that I because they weren't in, just trying to jump around and get in their thoughts or their comment and then go to commercial, or the lead broadcaster has to read a promo or all the stuff that that list of crap they have to deal with. And look, I get it, it pays the bills, but it also just makes it so hard to be a good producer. It makes it hard for the announcers. And I felt like everybody's roles were a little better defined. And so with that, there was a calmness that was great. It was better the first 2 days with Maltby and Coke, who just have that ability to say something in very few words to sum up a moment or a recollection of a past tournament, whatever it was. So that was great. Of course, they, Azinger predicted they'd have all the bells and whistles, and they did. And they, a lot of that's already kind of as part of the tour's takeover of the pictures. But they did a super job. The place looked great. I did feel like there were a couple holes that I don't know. I just felt like there were a couple camera things missing. I never got a good sense of 16, and that's my favorite hole there. And I don't know if there was something missing. But anyway, that's a nitpick. It was a very good show. They were not talking over each other. Everybody just had a more sensible approach, and it helped to have a great finish and to have stuff going on. We had rulings, we had some controversy. They generally stayed away from some of that, which was disappointing at times, but that's kind of the direction that I'm afraid it's going. So hopefully they keep it going. Unfortunately, I think the problem we know is that this was the tour's baby, and they always Tommy Roy lives there. They always go all out in making it a great show. But to your point, yes, I agree. There's something going on because Brandel, McGinley, and Rich had no problem every night saying stuff that they don't normally say there. They were just and not just related to Jay Monahan and tour politics and stuff, but really those player discussions were fascinating. They had no problem questioning some strategy, diving into stuff, the rulings, and so it was just great TV, that mainly because those three guys, the show's been chipped away at as well, but they carried it, and it was It was what I hope they can keep it going at the other majors, but definitely they were definitely not holding back compared to past years. And I know having worked there and worked on the live from that's a tough week. They're always a little more careful at the players.
The Maltby thing, yeah, right. I mean, less is more, isn't it? And I don't know, I sound like an old fuddy duddy here, but the older boys, I guess it comes with experience. You know, Smiley Kaufman can't wait to show everybody that he's friends with the players. And
yeah,
I mean, Kisner as well, you know, he's sticking up for his buddies. I'm sure he'll learn. If he's going to be any good, he's going to have to learn. But I kind of like Kisner's manner. I think he's a pretty good speaker. But yeah, Maltby's sign off. My goodness, I was almost crying myself. It was really, you just got a sense of it was an HR moment. You know, a guy who wanted to do the job, who was great at his job, is dispatched without much fanfare. I mean, just preposterous. And there's no reason why he shouldn't be at the Valspar this week and through the US Open. And my goodness. And you can see, again, you highlighted it in the quad, that, I mean, it was massively popular with the viewing public. And I don't think it was just sentiment. And, you know, it was people are generally appreciative. It's only when you see really or listen to really great broadcasters, you know what mediocre broadcasting is. And Maltby, I thought he kind of showed up some people. I'm conscious here, Jeff, we're talking about the US TV coverage. But the other thing, I don't know if this stuff is shown on Sky. I suspect not. Back in the UK and in Europe, the Smiley Kaufman thing. Fridays with Smileys? Is that what it's called? Do we approve of that?
Happy hour,
happy hour, jerk whatever.
I don't know. It's just it's brutal.
Okay, we'll leave that to one side. But the other, again, I've written this down. One of the breakout stars of the week was Johnson Wagner. Who the kind of on course analyst or however he's described. There's a couple of he got involved in the that was preposterous, by the way, the McIlroy Spieth / Hovland. I mean, it was just ludicrous, wasn't it? I mean, did I get that wrong? I mean, McIlroy did everything by the book. I don't know what the other two were trying to hint at. I thought, well, maybe they were pissed off with the drop he took on 18, which obviously they played the back nine first. But then I went back and looked at the drop on 18. My goodness, I've seen some horrendous drops on that hole, Jeff. And McIlroy was hitting his second shot from 300 plus yards. So he clearly hadn't been stealing any yards there, unlike some people over the years. So I don't know why Spieth or Hovland were pissed off at that one. But it was the evening. It was really funny, Johnson Wagner throwing the golf balls. It was just an absurd moment. He did a couple of other things. He tried to hit.
Wait. It was good. Go I mean, it was good. Absurd. I'm going to say this because when I worked with Golf Channel, I just bitched and moaned about the loss of the on course forensic. Frank Nablo used to do those, and it would be in the dark. He'd go out and find the divot or find the bunker shot or find where Phil hit his tee shot into left field. It's great TV and you learn things from it. It gives them something to debate. And I thought it was kind of they always said it's a rights thing, a broadcaster's issue. I don't know, but there they had the right to go back out there and do it. And there's no excuse now. They have these cameras where they don't need they're very easy to it's called live view, and it's very easy to do this kind of thing. And I thought it was great. And he, plus some tour footage, clearly vindicated Rory. You could see the ball bounce, and there's no way the ball bounces. There's no way you see the ball bounce if it's left of the line. And so but to your point on 18, I think you're right. That's what it was. And that is amazing because later on in the day, Max Homa hit one there that just started left and went left. And then Faxon on the broadcast says, he'll be able to drop that down the hole a little bit. You're like, Brad, what are you watching? That thing just went straight into the water. Like, no, he pretty much needs to re-tee it. But this is a problem they have at this course. Yeah, a lot of the tees are just the alignment is such that we've had these controversies, most famously with Tiger and Casey Wittenberg and Mark Rolfing and that whole thing. And there's Zapruder like films and the whack job
that was
convinced that everybody was in the conspiracy to help Tiger. It's just the way the course is set up with the hazards. But it was an odd vibe there. Victor and Jordan were oddly aggressive in a world where we never see players even bother to come over and look anymore when these things happen. And they were, so yeah, that was a strange one. And well, I guess maybe at some point we'll learn, but both of them should have been a little more worried about their own game, it turns out.
Yeah. Speaking of Victor, there's another guy fired his coach, short game coach's numbers over the weekend were absolutely atrocious. Actually, Victor has previous. He was the one that had to go with Daniel Berger a couple of years ago, I think. And he was in the wrong lane as well by miles. I actually replayed that. I went back and looked at that. Berger was rightly pissed off about that. But anyway, the other thing, we've got the TV coverage we've kind of covered. Jeff, you can tell me this as a layperson. I love that golf course. I've really grown to love that golf course. Is that just familiar that it's familiar to me now, or is it always genuinely been a great golf course, or is maybe you don't think it is a great golf course?
Well, it's always entertaining. I don't know how to describe it because it's changed so much. It's constantly changing. I think it's going to keep changing. The rough thing is just bizarre to me how they're, I guess the thing that I've always struggled with there is it takes driver out of their hands so much. And I even asked Pete Dye, you know, why don't you want to add some length here and get driver in their hands on a few holes where there's obvious room to extend it. And I'm never a fan of places where they don't get to hit many drivers. This tournament went very well with guys hitting a lot of irons off tees. And I'm in the minority. I love the new 12th hole. I didn't like the old 12th. I think it's a really fun drivable four. And I guess people feel like it's not Pete Dye enough. I don't know. I think it's a fascinating hole and it works. But again, I'm in the minority. The par fives are great. Pete had kind of a thing, you know, you shape it one way off the tee and you shape it the other way on the second. They're just so short now though, that's kind of a bummer. I looked at the stats last night and even number nine, which was always one of the hardest par fives in the world. It's like 4.6 average for the week and it's a pushover. Wow. So, but again, that all made the tournament exciting. They set it up tough, but it was a little soft this year. But I felt like that was done to kind of, like we've seen, you know, just ease into the week. And I just think people are not, as we learned at LA last year with the US Open, they're just not very tolerant. They all think that they can just control everything so easily and flip on the sub air, or the precision air, and flip it off. And they can't. And you saw by Sunday, the place was firming up and they had rain and it was browning out and it was getting crispy and it was just right on Sunday. And I guess I just think people expect this amazing amount of control over things, and that doesn't usually work. Golf courses work really well when there's a little bit of uncertainty, and they evolve as the tournament goes, and the players adapt as it goes. And I thought that's what happened here, and it was super. And nobody's going to remember the winning score, they're going to remember that it was a great final round and a lively week, and again, that's what all these weird little things that make a golf tournament great. There's some strange little intangibles sometimes, and this was a perfect example of all the things coming together.
And the leaderboard. I think the leaderboard suggests that the golf course really did its job. It identified the best players in the world.
Well,
there's any doubt about that.
Yeah, the people we've seen playing well in majors of late, and the people who play well on tough are demanding, or I mean a little bit of a plotters thing going on with the rough and the narrow fairways. But yes, I mean, you had your US Open champion, your Open Championship winner and a perennial contender and everything, and Xander Schauffele, who's been a somebody who likes that kind of tough golf course, all right there with a chance to win. So pretty exciting.
You mentioned Rafa. We shouldn't let the moment pass without the what was, I can't remember what Twitter feed it was. What was the Twitter feed, Jeff, that you
PGA about? Live Hot Takes.
Right. Well, if you go to Quadrilateral, go to PGA Live Hot Takes. There's a short video of Wyndham Clark. It's just preposterous. He wasn't mashing, as we talked about last week, but he was stomping around in the area in which he was about to drop his ball. It was horrifying. I mean, I'm in the very much. I really like Wyndham Clark. I think he's a very appealing golfer and an appealing kind of character. But that's 2 weeks in a row, Jeff. It was not edifying, not great. The other thing, the presentation ceremony. Actually, hang on a minute. I want to ask you, what about these Scheffler Woods Tiger comparisons? Are we buying that?
Oh, I didn't do it in my roundup. I saw people starting to do it, and I get it. When you I would just defend people. I saw some people annoyed by it, but look, when somebody's on a heater, as the kids like to say, is that how they say it? Anyway, you want to put it into perspective with the person who's been great, and Tiger Jack comparisons happened. And I think it's just a little too early, but I understand the inclination to want to try for people maybe who are newer to the sport or don't know much about the history to try to put in perspective what somebody's doing when it is definitely something that is spectacular, incredible, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't, it doesn't bother me, but I didn't do it because it's a little soon, but I do understand why people do it.
Yeah, I think it might be
long way to go.
Long way to go. He's won one. What is he, 27, 28, 29? I can't remember what age Scheffler is, but he's won one major. I mean, my goodness, come on, everybody, calm down. But he's playing great. He's just not very charismatic. I mean, does excellence equal charisma, Jeff? I'm not so sure. He's obviously excellent, but I'm not sure. I mean, he's just a kind of boring. You know, he doesn't look any different from a PGA players over the years. Tiger had it all, didn't he? He was just the best player that ever lived, and he was different. And anyway,
The hard part with Scotty is that he is very good off in terms of interviews, and you hear him talk, he's great. But on the course, it doesn't look like he enjoys what he does, even though he does.
It really doesn't.
No. And there's a lot of looking at the caddy and the show. Again, it's like the tennis people looking up to the box when every little thing goes wrong. And that gets a little tiresome to watch, I think. I mean, it happens. There are things that you go, what the heck was that? And you look at your caddy because who else are you going to look to? But he does it a lot. it gets a little bit, that's not great. So there just aren't many Lee Trevinos and Tigers and people with amazing reactions to moments who are otherwise very stoic. And so who knows, maybe in time but at least when he gives interviews, he's very good. And I think that's there. Yeah. Same thing with Jon Rahm. He looks miserable out there and he's cussing and he's neurotic, but he's very good in interviews. So I don't know. I don't know how the average fan views all that, to be honest with you. I really don't. But I do think when people are good in press conferences and good interviews, that goes a long way to make up for the stuff on the course. It's not as pretty. That said, you know, every time they went to Ludwig, he's just got a grin, and he's got this body language that's just cool customer, having a good time, loving what he does. And yeah, that's just who he is, and it's great to see.
I think people respond to that. It's a great point about Ludwig. People respond to that with Scheffler. It's I'm guessing there's a sports psychology thing of you got to stay even, but he doesn't even stay even. But if he goes one way, he's always, you know, throwing his golf ball when he misses a putt, or he just, as you say, he kind of looks miserable, and it's a real shame. Ludwig, as a well made point, the absolute opposite. Looks like a guy who loves what he's doing, loves that he's out there. So he was good. He was good again this week, Jeff. I think he might have a shot at the Masters. A couple of more things. This is funny. The presentation ceremony. Why? Any idea why Jay Monahan was booed?
Well, I mean, he was booed at the Tour Championship as well. I just think he's become a symbol fairly or unfairly, probably unfairly, of this, all this talk over time. And then he's rarely accessible. So I think to the average fan, they view him as some sort of culprit in this. And they've heard the Jimmy Walkers of the world or whoever the latest one is, Xander. And those aren't exactly, those guys have their things going on that make them judgmental. But yeah, he's not great in a press conference. He's not a great talker. Hands were in the pockets, which some people noticed, and Dean Beeman's looking at his watch, and yeah, the whole thing is just kind of it's kind of awkward. And so you add it all up, and yeah, he's sort of become the face of everything that's wrong with pro golf to some people. And it's certainly not all his fault. There's certain things he could have handled better, of course, but yeah, so that was wild. I did hear some trying to kind of scold the people who were booing, but made me laugh.
I just thought it was weird that the whole thing has transcended. That's not the right word. That has kind of crept into how the lay person or the general golf fan is now, you know, projected on him. Villainy is really strange. I can't imagine that anybody pays much attention to what Jimmy Walker said. What Jimmy Walker said was, I can't believe. I mean, in an interview with Bunker Magazine, I think it is. Jay's full of it. I thought that was quite astonishing. And Xander is clearly not having any of whatever Jay's selling. Xander's not having it. He had a go as well. It's outright mutiny, but the guy, he just sails on. Quite amazing. That actually, I should recommend a piece written by is it Keith Van Valkenburg?
Kevin
Noling up. He wrote a piece. Yeah,
Keith.
Kevin. Sorry. Yeah. Well, hang on. I've got the rest of it right. Kevin. Really. Apart from the four first person references in the first paragraph, it was a excellent piece. Really good reporting. Asking the question, well, why is Jay Monahan still in a job? It seems to have been, Jeff, that he it's just happenstance, a bit of luck. He's a useful cipher for certain interests who are controlling the PGA Tour, starting with Jimmy Walker and Ed Herlihy back in the day when they were secretly negotiating the framework agreement, the events of June the 6th, as we know it. Of course, if you remember, Jeff, we spoke about it at the time that there was this absolute bedlam after that announcement. But the only three people who knew what their jobs would be moving ahead were Jay Monahan, Jimmy Dunn, and Ed Herlihy. Since then, we have moved on. Dunn and Herlihy, or not Herlihy, but I think Dunn has been dispensed with.
No, he's on one of the boards. Yeah. He's on the he's still on the policy board. I don't think he's on the enterprises board. I think don't hold me to that, but I believe he's on one of the two boards still.
So then we move on to the, you know, the private equity stuff. Really interesting, Kevin. Really interesting stuff on, you know, how it was reached. The decision was reached. To allow Femi Sports Group, or the Strategic Sports Group, as they're called, to get their share or their piece of the PGA Tour. Of course, Jay has extremely strong links with the Femi Sports Group, which Kevin goes into in great detail. And also, just going back to the event, you know, the motivations for, you know, coming to some sort of agreement with PIF. You know, why did that happen? What were the motivations of Dunn and Herlihy? How that might tie into, say, Augusta National Golf Club and other people who might not. Of course, Yasser had his own motivation for not wanting to be deposed in any legal actions, but I'm sure Augusta National Golf Club, of which Herlihy and Dunn are stalwart members, also had their motivations for not wishing to be deposed. And the No Laying Up piece goes into all of that. Really, really fascinating stuff. A great reporting. I mean, we talk about the demise of legacy media, Jeff, but, you know, there are these alternative sources. Of course, Van Valkenburg came from ESPN, a serious journalist throughout his entire career. But really, I'm not saying it fully takes the place of those, the loss of the legacy media golf coverage, but my goodness, there's some pretty good journalists operating in the golf space. Van Valkenburg being one of them. As I say, if you haven't read that piece, go back and I'm sure it's on his Twitter feed or on the No Laying Up website or something. Really good stuff. Did you take anything from that piece? Anything more than my observations?
Yeah, just two things. I mean, obviously he maybe he danced a little bit, but it really was not hard to read between the lines that some of the hostility towards Jay is that now the current hostility is that this was an inside job. He steered to his buddies and he's going to keep his job despite doing a lousy job. That was kind of how I read some of that, and that's not ideal if these other people were interested in bidding, and that stood out. And I've never been able to understand how the tour was winning every case, doing so well, and then decided to settle. And I don't agree with a lot of these people who are mad that they were surprised by the news, because as we've seen, everything now that if you communicate it to the players gets leaked within 5 seconds. So I get that maybe, yes, there were groups of people like at Muirfield Village, the Captain's Club, that Jay might have been able to tell a few of those people when Rory did know, things like that. I don't know. You know, ultimately, Lawrence, it comes down to it's a clubby sport. These guys all are in a club. They want to stay in their clubs. They want to know they're in the club, and they want to know information so that they feel like they're in the club and everybody who's not in the club doesn't know what's going on in the club. And so much of Jay's issue, or the issues that they have with Jay, revolve around that, not the actual substance of things or that they actually care about the long-term good of the game or the sport. It's that they didn't get the information, and that Jay didn't treat the fellow members the right way. And it's kind of gross in a sense. And I think, I don't think Jimmy Walker's criticisms were all driven by that. In fact, I know they weren't, because I think he was very clear on, he just has views on, you just look at some of the great stories this year on the tour, and those guys were not in the top 100. And if you're going to go to 100 players, you know, and if you're going to be Wyndham Clark and say, I want to go to 100, well, have you already? I mean, it wasn't that long ago that Wyndham Clark was just outside the 100 trying to be that breakthrough player. And that time as a non-top 100 player developed him into a top 5 player. So some of these guys need to listen. You know, maybe Jimmy had some rants, or he's had his share. He certainly came after me one time. It's a little scary when Jimmy's mad at you. I don't even know why he was mad still, but he is not wrong that they have to remember back to why a full field at the Players worked. You know, there are things that have worked for a long time, and throwing that all out and not having somebody at the top who's able to kind of keep the various forces at bay and keep their egos in check is really hurting right now. And that's where Tim Fincham was so good at his job. And I think Dean Beaman was good before him at the same thing. I mean, think about the egos Dean Beaman had to deal with. I'm reading Hughes Norton's book right now, and the stuff that went on in the creation of the tour and break away from the PGA of America. And that took a strong personality in Dean to kind of build off of that. So it's still shocking though, to see these people just ripping him left and right and so hostile to him. So obviously there's other stuff we don't all understand as well. That's in play here. And it's still quite a mess.
If Jay's looking for a bit of consolation, he might want to go to the Global Golf Post, where I believe the North Korean Communications Department is now taking out a subscription. There is quite an astonishing, really, I would never recommend going to read Global Golf Post.
Oh, come on now. You're being a little harsh.
Right, okay. Anyway, that might be the worst piece. There's a profile of Jay Monahan. That might be, I mean, I've read a lot of bad journalism over the years, but that might take the absolute biscuit. It's as I say, North Korea. North Korea would be jealous. Kim Jong-un would be jealous.
So what bothered you about the piece? I mean, John Hopkins wrote a piece where Jay kind of lays out what goes on with his life. And yes, but I mean, what, I mean, I understand why they did the story, or they wanted the story out there to try to humanize him and make him people understand his side of things a little bit more. I mean, didn't touch on any of the hot button issues. It was more about the last year for Jay. But what troubled you most, I guess, is what I'm
Well, saying. Here's some I can't believe that people are being paid in the hundreds of thousands of dollars for communications advice, but here's some free communications advice. If you want to humanize your subject, you pick a proper, you know, credible forum in which to do that. I'd direct people to the recent New Yorker profile of Joe Biden, which was very, you know, balanced, but, you know, it didn't pull any punches. And a great writer, very fair writer, and lo and behold, it, you know, it establishes a certain amount of credibility. Well, both for the New Yorker, which probably doesn't need it, but certainly if people are looking to reassess Joe Biden, that's a pretty credible piece, a pretty credible source. This was just preposterous. It was sheer sycophancy from beginning to end. And a not very credible source. Anyway, I guess I just differ because
I understand your point, but he basically transcribed a lot of what Jay said. And I think there's some stuff there that will be interesting to see how it ages. And, you know, kind of like the Greg Norman, Andy Hill, go to Augusta story that Tim Rosefort reported that people rolled their eyes at. And that ended up being quite the nugget a few years later when Greg ran off with Andy's wife. So things like that, I understand. Again, I understand, but there's some stuff in the piece where this will be interesting to see how this ages. But
that is unintentional. If that happens, that would be unintentional. Have to believe that the motivation for doing this was intentional. And to that end, it failed miserably. I'm guessing. I mean, I don't know. There might be as I say, if Jay's looking for some consolation, he would have got 5 minutes of satisfaction out of it. Anyway, we're spending too much time on it. We should move on, Jeff. We're running out of time. We are speaking late on Monday afternoon, California time. So no word yet, unless I haven't scrolled Twitter or seen anything. I should just forget. Did we mention the fact that Joe Ogilvie's been co-opted onto the former friend of the pod? He won't be a friend of the pod now.
Yeah, it's going to be tough to get Joe on the show.
Yeah.
I think he's an executive again.
Yeah. So I wonder, answer me this, Jeff. Do you think that was Jay Monahan's idea? I suspect not.
Oh, no. No, this was totally about, yeah, maybe they're having a hard time finding a replacement, we've heard. And that's why Jay is still in the commissioner's job. I can't speak to the PGA Tour Enterprises job. Who knows, he might stay in that job. But no, my immediate reaction when I saw the news, because I know Joe enough to know he's got a great life in Austin and things are going really well for him. And he seems very happy doing what he's doing. So I don't think he gets involved in this mess and knowing all the meetings he'll have to sit in without the possibility of that it could lead to that, or that he would be groomed for that. And, you know, Jay, that's one of the things that Jay's done, is he's surrounded himself with his people. And speaking of, sycophants, and I think it's why he's gotten in trouble a lot, and he's moved people around and all this weird executive shuffle stuff that's been going on for several years that you just go, wait, that person got moved? What was wrong with that person? We like that person. And don't you have better things to do and constantly moving people around? And so they spend a lot of time on their executive, what do you call it? It's not the seating chart. What's the org? I don't know the org chart.
Anyway,
the org chart. And so Joe is now not on the org chart, and suddenly he is. And the Jay liked to, I noticed in the press conference, kept getting his title right, the liaison director. So it clearly came after, negotiating this very, trying to keep the guy's lane, very narrow. And, I think Joe would be a really interesting commissioner, so I could see why it would be totally a threat. He's more articulate on camera. He's a former player. He knows how to listen to his peers. He's listened to it already. He's served in these roles. So, And now, why the hell he'd want to do this, I don't know. But you know, $18 million and a a jet that just you can take you wherever you want. Steamboat Springs when you want to go hit the slopes. Go pick up Webb Simpson, so he can be at the meeting in the Bahamas. You know, that's a nice perk. That's a really nice perk. So I could see the allure of that.
I wonder if he's would be tough, not tough's the wrong words, but you know, prepared to put people in their place. Maybe, I mean, I don't know him well enough. But anyway, he's a super smart guy, very, very well intentioned, loves golf, absolutely loves golf. Actually, I recommend this, I think I've recommended it before, the Roberto Castro's podcast, I think it's The Course Record. Episode one was Joe Ogilvy talking about his life as a PGA Tour pro. One of my top three golf podcasts of all time. If you haven't listened to it, go and listen to it. It's fantastic. We should finish this off, Jeff. Actually, very quickly, Maurice Bembridge died. Great player, great Ryder Cup player, great European Tour player. We watched it before we started the podcast, Jeff. The Ryder Cup motivational video from 2018 starts with Bembridge at home talking about, my goodness, I'm already talking about it and I've got goosebumps. Really, just a, you know, proper stalwart, really good player, proper stalwart of the European Tour. He died pretty young, 76, I think it was. Didn't you mention it in the quadrilateral? I think you did, didn't you?
I did. I had a few things wrong. It turned out I got confused by a couple of incorrect things and stories that I should have figured out. And but yes, I had the gist of his greatest accomplishments regarding his Ryder Cup career. And I went back and he did get one shot. He shot 64 in the final round of the Masters, which now is a record he holds with seven other people. Anyway, a lot of other people, most recently by Rory McIlroy. And he made a putt on 18, about a 25 footer for birdie downhill, and eight birdies, no bogeys, final round. It got him a T9, and a very cool moment to see that. And also just started making me watch an old Masters. But and then you reminded me of his role in a recent Ryder Cup inspirational video, right, which I'm going to put in this week's newsletter just to follow up because it's so great.
Oh, my goodness. It's absolutely wonderful. Yeah, T9th, I think it was the 74 Masters. It's actually an achievement to actually to get for a European player to get in the Masters in 1974. Yeah, so...
Wonder, you know, that's a great question. What was his status? Did they took Walker Cup teams. Did they take Ryder Cup teams as well?
Oh,
yeah, I'm gonna have to look that up. I mean, I'm actually curious now. Yeah.
The enemy Maurice Bembridge, rest in peace. We should finish with Yasser, and we are speaking, as I say, at late Monday afternoon. So there's no news out yet of the Bahamas. Firstly, Jeff, the Bahamas. I thought this meeting, Eamon Lynch got that wrong. I'm only teasing Eamon. The meeting between Yasser and the policy board members of the PGA Tour taking place in the Bahamas. Why do you think it's taking place in the Bahamas, Jeff? And well, not maybe the mainland USA?
Tiger had the yacht down there and maybe he said, you know, I can have it on the yacht. There's no listening devices I know of on the yacht. And you guys can stay here at Joe's place, whatchamacallit, Albany. I don't know. I don't know much about extradition, and I'm sure the Bahamas, I'm sure they have a lovely custom service there that allows you to just, you know, just do it right on the jet or something. I'm sure, knowing the, you don't get that at Jacksonville Airport or where's the place they all land for the Ponte Vedra set. Anyway, it's a little south of the players in the TPC, but do you have any theories? But yeah, they're all flying to the Bahamas, multiple jets, John Henry, the Strategic Sports Group, which of course, you know, they just want to meet Yasir and go, you know, we have a lovely thing here. We could use a little more pitching though this year.
Yeah, that's right.
Have you thought about investing in Major League Baseball, Yasir?
I mean, there is a lot of the kidnapping lawsuits flying around. You just kind of wonder if he landed in mainland US, he might get served for something. Who knows?
Same. I mean, if he's flying to the Bahamas, a flight to Ponte Vedra, there's no difference. So if he's coming from Saudi Arabia, we don't know where he's coming from. But anyway, the idea of just all these jets descending upon this, and Tiger's there with his yacht and his plane, and it's just all a little bit much.
The optics of that, why is the PGA Tour not great, is it? I mean, once again, you know, running around at the whim of Yasser Al-Rumian. So they're all in the Bahamas. Goodness knows what's going on. We're all guessing. I don't care. Whoever types anything or puts out anything in social media tonight, they don't know. Nobody knows. I guess we can all speculate. I mean, we now live in the age of speculation and conspiracy theories. I'm talking about the royal family right now. Apparently, the royal family ruled out, according to you, Jeff, a body double today, pretending to be Princess Kate or whatever her name is. Anyway,
title correct. Come on.
Oh, career, sure.
Show some respect.
So, again, we have no idea. Who knows? Pretty good authority that there will be a deal. I mean, it's not breaking any new ground to say that. Pretty good authority that there will be a deal ultimately. The question is the timing and the shape of that deal. But some fairly sane person with absolutely no knowledge of what's going on, directing me to comments from Rory yesterday. I thought they were, and I looked at them. Really interesting. He was asked about these negotiations. Obviously, he welcomed it. He's been calling for some kind of rapprochement between the PGA Tour and LIV. I wrote the quotes down actually. Rory's emphasizing not trying to drive a wedge, but trying to emphasize the difference between the PIF, i.e. Yasser, and LIV Golf. He thinks there's a big disconnect between PIF and LIV. And the closer that we, i.e. the PGA Tour, can get to Yasser, the better to understand is to desire to contribute to golf in a productive way. He's saying the people at LIV have done him a disservice. So I just wonder, obviously Rory's somewhat estranged from the PGA Tour policy board at this stage, but that would be, and tactically, that would be quite a good move for the PGA Tour to try and drive a wedge between Yasser and LIV. I mean, would Yasser abandon LIV at this stage? He might be that way inclined, were he to be tempted by a pretty smooth deal with the PGA Tour. Here you go, Yasser. We'll give you 10% of the PGA Tour or whatever it is. And guess what? You will be a part of a reunited world of golf. My goodness, what a great investment that would be. The only condition is that you just abandon LIV. I mean, the Saudi regime, of which Yasser is an integral part, have shown, they have a history of abandoning things, people, investments, and moving on quickly. And that might, if it was a case that they were, he was offered a smooth deal with the PGA Tour, and that would include a portion of a reinvigorated and renewed world of professional golf. That might be quite tempting, and maybe that's what McIlroy is getting at with trying to make a distinction between PIF and LIV Golf. Does that sound at all plausible to you, Jeff?
Yeah, I think it's a way to allow him to save face if they were to come to an agreement and then kill LIV or knock it down to a smaller package of things and the franchise thing, and you know, just to diminish it in any way you need to help him save face. The only problem with the theory is that he had to have greenlit the signing of John Rahm for the amount of money we're talking about. That one, there's no way that the Greg Norman and the other people did that on their own. Whereas, yeah, like Anthony Kim was probably, it sounded like Greg Norman saw some sort of opening in his mind, stick it to the tour, and expedited that project. probably on his own or with whoever. We don't even know who the key executive at the top is now. But so I think it's a wise strategy. It's just a matter of, what is the pathway that makes sense for both sides to kind of put an end to this? And that's what they have to figure out. And, we all can speculate on some, we all have some ideas, but it's a great idea to give him that ability to say, the people below me kind of got out of hand. And I think there's real, the only thing they all seem to agree on is that they can't stand Greg Norman. So that's something he brings everybody together in agreement on that. Although I don't know about Yasir, he's kept him to this point. And he was with Steve Cohen at Mets spring training on Sunday. So maybe Greg, the question is, did Greg come down to the Bahamas with Steve on Steve's jet? And will he be at the meeting? Yeah, all that's kind of hilarious when you know the egos involved, but I think it's a fascinating thing I think Rory's kind of in a semi-troll mode at times, having some fun just screwing with these people at this point. But I don't know, in this case I don't think that was what he was doing, but I would never rule it out. I just think he can't stand Greg Norman, and I think when he it sounds like when he's had time with Yasir, he's found him to be sincere in what he's trying to do, and I think if you look at what they're trying to do in tennis now, there might be some parallels here. But again, you still have this problem where the American golfers want to play what are we calling it now? The senior AJGA tour? What was it you called it
Oh
last week?
the senior AGGA. No, the AGGA senior tour. That's
Yeah,
what
there
it
you
is.
go. Yeah, let's get the branding. Let's nail that branding.
The
So there's that problem still, that they want to be in America. They want to play in Jupiter, Dallas, Scottsdale, and Hilton Head, and never leave the U.S. And Piff would like to be in this to be an international thing, and I just don't think there's any way around that at this point. So a lot to sort out. I mean, there's just no way they're doing anything quickly at this
No,
point, so get used to
I
it.
just again just go to go back to Rory's words, his desire talking about Yasser and his desire to help to be in golf in a productive way. I thought that was a really interesting. I mean, if I'm Yasser, I mean that we're being asked to believe that he's somehow wedded to team golf. He can't be. I mean, he is a global player in private. I mean, it's just who cares? Team golf, not team
I
golf.
just think you
Yeah, well,
follow the
maybe you
money,
can.
Lawrence. That's where the value is if they can create franchises. And I mean that with the billionaire set right now, franchises are the thing. The tax benefits, the ego stuff, the value creation, all that. There's something there, and he's that he. I believe we've seen plenty of reporting that he is very much in on that. So you can
Yeah,
poo-poo
well.
it, but I think it's I don't think it's going away. And hey, and
Well,
think about again, we have I think you agree that if it had been executed better, if these franchises were more nationality driven, that there's something there. But when they have these stupid names and stupid uniforms and hokey cheese bally stuff, that it does it's lost some luster, and I don't know if you can get that back. But I think that I do. I just don't think we agree. I think there's something there. I don't know what it is, but and we've seen it with the Ryder Cup. Obviously, it'll never have the same thing because there'll be corporate logos attached and things. But I think there's something there to him, and
well,
that's something they have to overcome.
if I'm Yasser, I'm looking at I've invested 100 million in the Asian Tour, which is a far more compelling product than LIV Golf. I mean, who knows when the next LIV Golf event is? Who cares? Nobody cares. Which team wins? Nobody cares, apart from me and the Majestics, obviously.
Right,
But
of
again,
course.
I find myself late Wednesday night looking up the Asia Tour leaderboards.
Well, that's because you need help.
And
You need help.
Well, and
That's, yeah.
but I'm wishing, God, I wish there was somewhere I could watch this. I mean, it's an utterly. This week was another. It was in Macau, I think. This week I was a playoff, John Caitlin, the American veteran, I guess he's 40 years old, 38 years old, whatever, beat David Puge in a playoff. Lots of really great, one of my friends was down there watching it, some really great young Asian players. We were just laughing together about the AGGA Senior Tour and all these American guys, these entitled American guys, don't know what's coming down the pipeline. There's about half a dozen Asian kids coming down, late teens, early 20s. There's TK, the kid is going to Stanford next year. What a player he is. He finished, I think, top 30 this week. There's our old pal Denwit. I'm not going to try and pronounce his second name. But if I'm Yasser, I'm looking at that. It's a full field, 36-hole cut, really compelling product, exciting. The golf courses are too easy, so the scoring is just absurd every week. But it's producing great young players who are going to be great stories. And then I look at LIV Golf, and it's a product that nobody cares about. I could pitch that scenario to Yasser and tell him, here's the alternative. 10% of reunited PGA Tour. My goodness, can you imagine, Jeff, the first season when that everybody comes back together and everybody's all the best players in the world truly are playing together most weeks? That would be something that somebody like Yasser would want to be a part of, I would imagine.
He's a businessman, Lawrence. The Asian Tour having John, even though you and I know that John Caitlin shooting a 59, first time ever on the Asian Tour and winning after losing basically all status, we like that story. But when you're controlling $1 trillion at some point, I think is where it's going to be. Some people have already been using the trillion number. How does that get you excited? Whereas the money they've spent on LIV, they're going to want something back. You've heard the Crown Prince. He doesn't care if it's called sport washing, if it grows his GDP by 1.5% or whatever the number was. So I don't agree. I think he's going to want a business story behind this that he can sell to the Crown Prince.
We'll leave it at that, Jeff.
No, that'll be news
tonight. Yeah, there'll be news tonight out of Bahamas. I don't know how accurate it will be, but there'll be something, I would imagine. This week, I did write it down. We do, surprising as this may sound, we do a little plan for this podcast every week, but we're usually all over the place. I did finish it off with, let's talk about the Valspar this week, but we've decided not to bother. who cares? Another full field 72-hole stroke play event on the PGA Tour.
It'll probably be good. Yeah. Oh, didn't they expand? I think they expanded the next two fields. Some weird. They're just making stuff up as they go. I just love it. They're just making it up. Oh, we need to add some people because people. It's amazing after all these years of hearing how they can't do this because of these rules, and now they're just making it up. The problem, though, Lawrence, and not to go on a tangent, because I know you're trying to sign us off here, the problem is it's also extending to their view of the rules of golf and the equipment rules, and I find that extremely obnoxious about this organization. They want to govern the game. They want to be the organization and that dictates everything, including the rules of golf, although they've always chickened out on creating the rules of golf that they threatened to create. But they are showing that if we ever put those things in their hands, they can't be trusted. They're in it for their own interests, and that's it. And there you go. So they need to get on board with the rollback and shut up, and also start. You know, it is important that their players play by the rules, because if they get the reputation that they don't enforce the rules, they're people like Yasser and you are not going to find them to be worth whatever it is they want. You have to have some integrity. And so there you go. I'll stop now.
Right. Okay. Okay, Jeff, good luck with your Hall of Fame induction. And maybe one day you will be inducted into the Southern
Cal. No.
If you do enough of these, if you do enough of these dinners, they're going to have to give you a bobble at some point. Anyway, okay, I will talk to you next week, pal. All the best. Take care.
Thanks, Lawrence.
Hunting down reach out just to touch you. Then I realize it's a wide open road. Then I realize it's a wide open road. It's a wide open road.